We have 10 propositions that are coming up in November.
Proposition 2, which is a school bonds issue. Proposition 4, which is
infrastructure. Yeah.
Infrastructure. Every time you pass a bond, you're basically saying to the next generation, here's our gift to you, a debt. And they're going to have to pay that off. Supporters say all of these things are important and reasonable and you should pay for them anyway, and your children will thank you for it.
There is another one on minimum wage.
You have to understand that the people who will be paying for the cost of that minimum wage are the consumer. That's inflation right there. What's the counter argument? They will say that the cost of living is so high, we must raise the minimum wage. The people who work at minimum wage can't afford to live in California right now.
So you have to really understand where it's going and is it worth it?
That's
right.
Voting. That's right.
My guest today is Will Swaim, president of California Policy Center. Today he's here to tell us what ballot initiatives we'll expect to see in November election. Will is going to try to argue on both sides of these issues and to tell us what these propositions are about. At California Insider, we like to show you both sides of the argument. And multiple sides of the argument, so you can make up your own mind. Now, what about Prop 35?
One of the most complicated, I'm just gonna call it a swindle. So you pause, as I did when I read this, and I said, huh, why would somebody wanna tax themselves? Here's where the mystery gets really fascinating.
I'm Siamak Karami. Welcome to California Insider. Will, it's great to have you back on. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks for inviting me.
We want to talk to you about ballot propositions. Last time you came here and we had a discussion on these a few years ago, and we went over what they were and what they mean after the election. This time we want to talk to you about before, because a lot of people wanted to know about them and wanted us to discuss them before the election's coming up.
Yeah, I think what's great about a conversation about these ballot measures is that they raise really fundamental questions about how one views the role of government in California. And it raises just kind of first principles, real basic fundamental economics questions, government questions, philosophical questions. We've got five that are numbered 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Then we've got five more that are numbered 32, 33, 34, 35, 36. So we're going to talk about 2 through 6 first. Let's note that 3 of these really are about bonds. And bonds, B-O-N-D-S, are a financial instrument that governments use to raise money to spend on a thing. Now, it used to be literally they spent it on a thing, like a dam or a road or a bridge. Increasingly, we see bonds being used ostensibly, that means supposedly, for a thing, but in fact, it's so the government has more money to pay for government operations. That is especially for employees or the cost of renting buildings, that sort of thing. So Proposition 2 is about building school facilities. Now, there's a really interesting wrinkle in this. Proposition 2 sets up a state matching fund. That is to say that if a local bond passes, it will be matched dollar for dollar by state taxpayers. So you and I are here in Orange County. If some local community actually passes a local school bond to build, you know, to rehab its buildings or build an athletic field.
To improve the building, yeah.
Right, right. This all sounds very reasonable. But now there's an added bonus in it. And if you're a supporter of this thing, you say, well, this is really great. State taxpayers everywhere in California will be matching you dollar for dollar on your local bond. This makes local bonds more exciting, more attractive. Now, again, because we're going to be paying this off over time, I want to point out something else. There's an interest payment on this. You're going in a bond, you're borrowing money from, let's call it Wall Street, loosely, right? You're borrowing it from financial institutions. You're borrowing this money, $10 billion, $20 billion, whatever it is. You're borrowing it from a Wall Street firm. Well, the Wall Street firm wants to make money on that. They're the bank, if you will.
They're going to charge interest.
They're going to charge interest. So now we have a bond that's advertised, let's just make up a number, at $5 billion in your local community, right? Well, the state's going to match it. So now there's a $10 billion cost.
Does the match come out of these $10 billion?
Yes.
Okay.
Proposition 2 is a match for the local bond. So I just want people to be thinking about this because they're going to see this in the advertising supporting a bond. Like, hey, if you vote for this bond, it's going to be matched by Sacramento. Well, Sacramento is also you and your neighbors and people who live all over the state. So now the $5 billion bond becomes a $10 billion bond because of the match. Well, there's also interest on this over 30 years. That's another $5 billion. So now this bond that is advertised at $5 billion is costing the state of California and local taxpayers a total of $15 billion. But I know that's a lot of math for a conversation. But my point is, be careful, because the people paying this off are typically not us. I'm just going to be fully disclosing here and say I'm 64. I'm not going to be around in 30 years.
You look a lot younger.
Oh, well, that's really good, but it's not going to save me from death. I will not likely be paying back some of the bonds that passed this year, if the actuarial tables are correct. I will be long gone. But my children will be around, and my grandchildren will be paying this thing off. And the question is, do I really want to increase the costs of living in California for them? Because every time you pass a bond, you're basically saying to the next generation, here's our gift to you. A debt, and they're going to have to pay that off. So you really want to be careful.
So now, what are other bonds?
Sure. So that was number two. Proposition four is a different one. That's
for this parks one, and
for parks. That's right. Well, it had been called just a park bond, then a water bond, and then a climate bond, and now I think it includes all those things.
The last infrastructure, water infrastructure.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So, you know, I think this one is, what's that old joke about a camel is an animal that has been assembled by a committee? That's this bond. You know, I think they've really kind of focus grouped it, the supporters of this bond. They've gotten a bigger coalition of people who can kind of endorse it. And the goal is always to signal to voters, hey, look at all the people who are in this thing. Well, who doesn't like a park? Who doesn't want water? Who doesn't want, you know, a better energy infrastructure? Well, just about everybody wants these things, right? So the question becomes, why is it that California, which has spent more than every other state and most nations on things like parks and climate and water, why is it that we haven't built a dam in 40 years? Why is it that we have an electric system that is aging and usually when there's a high wind starts a wildfire? A lot of this is because of infrastructure and misspending, I would argue. But supporters say, like, look, we've got to stop the climate change problem. We've got to have more water because water is becoming more scarce because of climate change. We need better energy infrastructure. We need more parks. But the fact is, again, just as I mentioned with Prop 2, you got to think about the fact that this is just a bond is a tax by other name, right? And it's a tax that you may not just be paying, but that your children and their children will be paying, your neighbors are paying. And so this too will add to the high cost of living in California. Supporters say all of these things are important and reasonable and you should pay for them anyway, and your children will thank you for it. I think this is a really interesting question.
You have to consider those facts that you're going to pay a lot of interest, and then if you want to vote for it, then you can think about if those projects
That's right.
are worth it.
Well, what's interesting about Proposition 2 is that most of the money, this is progressive groups don't like this either. They don't like Proposition 2. And these progressives are sometimes teachers and poor school districts and the poor school districts themselves, because they point out that the places where bonds are most likely to pass are in wealthier districts. Wealthier districts tend to get $4,000 to $5,000 more per student because they pass more bonds. So Proposition 2, progressives would point out, and when I talk about progressives, I'm talking about, you know, broadly speaking, left liberals, let's call them, people who are to the left of in the Democratic Party. They don't like this because they see this rightly, I think, as exacerbating the income disparity, the wealth disparity, inequality. And so that's something else to keep in mind with Proposition 2. So the other one to think about, you've got Proposition 2, which is a school bonds issue, which sets up that matching fund that we described. You've got Proposition 4, which is parks, water, energy, climate.
Infrastructure. Yeah.
Infrastructure, right. And then you've got Proposition 5. Now, this is one of those that requires more math. So we probably already lost half of our audience at this point. All the math professors and teachers are really excited. But in California, we have a law that says that if you're going to pass a tax hike on people or a bond, if you're going to put a bond on the ballot, that it has to pass with 66.75%.
So two-thirds of the voters.
Two-thirds.
Yeah.
Thank you, doctor.
Yeah.
You have to pass it with two-thirds of the vote. Well, the people who like bonds don't like that. They want to drop the requirement to 55%.
So that is easier for
it. So it's easier to pass. So keep in mind, Prop 2 would set up a matching fund for bonds that makes them more attractive. Prop 4, climate, water, energy, infrastructure. Prop 5 says we want to make it easier to pass all these things going forward, so we're going to drop the minimum vote required to pass a bond. So that changes dramatically the whole political landscape of how people put bond initiatives on the ballot and whether they're going to pass.
And now Prop 5 was more about it's specific to infrastructure and housing, right?
Yes, that's right. So it tries to carve out an exception, and it says housing, but what it really means is low-income housing. And what it really means then is we're going to pass a bond to build low-income housing, which the government will build, and then we can circumvent the usual supermajority, that 66%, you know, two-thirds majority of voters. You know,
And that two-thirds comes from Prop 13, right?
That's correct. Yes.
Which is a very popular proposition.
Very popular. So this is a way around that. You know, Californians are notoriously stingy about raising taxes, as they ought to be, right? Because taxes make it more expensive to live. And people are constantly, rightly complaining about the cost of living in California. Bonds are a tax. Not because people are trying to hide the ball, but because that's how a bond works.
It is so you have to really understand where it's going and is it worth it when
that's
you're
right.
voting.
That's right.
Now, what about Prop 3?
Well, Prop 3 is an interesting one. And we have to do a little history here. Fortunately, history I'm better at than math. But in 2008, California voters passed Proposition 8, which effectively banned gay marriage. It defined marriage as only between a man and a woman. But California, this is how far away California was in 2008, go forward to 2024. The Supreme Court eventually overturned that. The U.S. Supreme Court overturned Proposition 8 and said, no, this is a decision to be made by adults. Consenting adults can make this decision. Interestingly, however, Proposition 8 is still embedded in state law. It's not effective because it has now been outlawed, banned, overturned by the Supreme Court. But it's still in there. And for some people, this really bothers them. So supporters of Proposition 3 say this is a cleanup bill. What we're really doing here is just bringing what's in the state law. We're cleaning up a law that no longer belongs there because federal law has basically overturned it. There are other people, however, opponents who say, you know what? Every time the California legislature puts a cleanup bill on the state ballot, what they really mean is, we're going to clean things up in our favor and broaden rights in some other area that you cannot even anticipate. So my own sense is that people are entitled to reach their own opinion on this. There are other social conservatives who say, I think marriage should only be between a man and a woman. And, you know, the Supreme Court of the United States be damned. We really need to clean up this. We really need to make sure that marriage is only between a man and a woman. There are others who say that ship has sailed. And the Supreme Court made it very clear right after Proposition 8 passed by overturning it and making it illegal.
There is another proposition, Prop 6, that has to do with prisoners working.
Yes. So Proposition 6 says that it is eliminating involuntary labor, involuntary servitude, they call it. And that's the practice in California prisons of requiring prisoners to do some work to pay for their own upkeep. That might be working in the prison laundry. It might be doing maintenance around the prison. It might be working in the prison kitchen. It could even be, you know, for some people who get these really coveted jobs, it means going out and fighting wildfires, which you can imagine for some prisoners being locked up in their cell all day is not quite as attractive as getting to go work in a kitchen, never mind getting to go into the outdoors, even for very dangerous work like fighting fires. Now, proponents of this bill say this is equivalent to slavery. I'm just going to reveal my entire personal philosophy on this. I think that, you know, prisoners are by definition in prison involuntarily. They didn't go there because they volunteered for it. That's number one. Prison itself is an involuntary place to go. Second, the victims of your crime didn't volunteer to be victims. Third, I think it's not fair to the taxpayers of California to say suddenly, no, no, you take a break, we'll pay for everything. I think it's reasonable to ask people to help pay for the costs of their incarceration. And then I think what we now know is that a lot of the prisoners actually like this, and many benefit from prison labor because it gives some of them a way to build experience, skill that they have not previously had out in the real world. It allows them to work and get jobs once they get out. There's a very famous place up in San Francisco, a restaurant called Delancey Street, which hires ex-convicts, ex-addicts, people who live in their system and then work in their restaurant. It's all voluntary now. But these are people who in prison worked in prison kitchens. They worked in the prison laundry. They built, in other words, a resume. So when they come to Delancey Street, they can say, look, I'm not on drugs.
They know how to do a job.
I know how to do a job.
Got trained. Because some of the people that have gone to prison, they've forgotten how to have to hang on to a job. And
yeah, or never had one. And so, you know, one of the constant complaints from a lot of us is that the prison system is really a place that incubates more criminality, because it is often a place where good, you know, reasonably good people,
young people go there, and then they get worse over the years.
They get worse over time because they're interacting with people who will tell them how to become more sophisticated criminals. We lack, I think, the capacity sometimes to think in really, I think, limited ways about the capacity to help people become better in prison. And I think this is one of those places where conservatives and liberals overlap. I don't know anybody who wants prison to be strictly only a place of severe and unrelenting hell. I think most people, even people who are there on death row, I want them to have time to become better humans. From my own spiritual perspective, to find God, let's say, or to find some purpose in living day to day. I think that's only human. Now, people may disagree with me, but I think that asking people to work to support themselves is a fundamentally American idea, that people ought to pay their own way to some extent. Believe me, the work that prisoners do in prison doesn't come close to paying back the cost that taxpayers pay.
Because the cost is over $100,000 per year.
It's about $100,000, yes, to put a person in jail for 1 year. That's more than the cost of sending them to Stanford. So I think we have a right as taxpayers to ask the people who are there do something to pay us back for the cost of their incarceration. And again, I think there are added benefits. I think humans are built to work. And I don't mean to be slaves. That's what the other side, that's what the proponents of this bill say.
The proponents are saying that this is not fair to these guys. You're making them work. You're not paying
them. That's correct. Yes, they say, look, this is just like slavery. Nope. In slavery, it was the color of your skin in America that got you enslaved. It wasn't because you had committed a crime. It was pure and simple that we did not like the color of your skin and we decided that you deserved to be enslaved. Here, you have to actually commit a crime to be in prison. So, you know, and we have to assume, I think, again, that once you're in prison, the chance to actually make yourself better, to feel like you're contributing, to have a job to show up for that's meaningful, that actually allows you to help feed and clothe and clean others, you know, clean the prison itself, to provide clean clothing and bedding, to provide work in the kitchen, to provide food. These are valuable, I'll call them spiritual or psychological or sociological benefits, whatever you prefer. These are benefits of incarceration. They are not slavery. In fact, the 13th Amendment, to which the supporters often point, which eliminated slavery, makes an exemption that the only time that you can force somebody to work is when they've been convicted of a felony. That's the only time. So the people who are in prison are well within our rights to ask, please, do some labor.
There is another one on minimum wage.
Well, this is Proposition 32, and I'll just put my cards on the table here. When we talk about the minimum wage, I want everybody to really be thinking about, and this is just, this is one side of the argument. This is my argument, and we'll come to the supporters' argument. We have to remember that this will be inflationary. If you think the cost of living is high now, it will go higher when you raise the minimum wage. Now, what's the counter argument? That's crazy, they will say. They will say that the cost of living is so high, we must raise the minimum wage. That people who work at minimum wage can't afford to live in California right now. That we have to put more money in their pockets. But again, I can only come back to the fact that business isn't going to pay for this. The consumer will. Who's the consumer? The guy who's now getting $18 an hour. So you give somebody $2 an hour more per, in a minimum wage capacity, and you feel good about yourself for a minute until you realize the cost of everything they produce just went up to account for that $2 an hour increase. And who's on that hamster wheel right now? The person making 18 bucks an hour, who for a minute feels really good, like, oh boy, I got a raise, until they go and they check out the prices of every other good or service in California.
We're covering California issues, as you know. If you want us to cover the stories that are impacting your day-to-day life in California, reach out to me at siamak@californiainsider.com. What about Prop 33? This is about the rent control,
that's right?
That's
right. Well, in order to talk about 33, we're also going to want to talk about 34. I hope that's okay. So these are two propositions being fought out by the same two groups. Let me explain. Proposition 33.
Because 34 is really about healthcare.
That's right? What it says. We're going to explain. So 33 is overtly about rent control. It proposes eliminating any restriction on the right of local governments to impose rent control. Well, this is immediately opposed by the California Apartment Association, which owns, you know, represents the owners of major apartments, and including down to the level of just, you know, a family that owns a little duplex, fourplex, whatever. So apartment owners oppose this because they do not want rent control. Policy people like me aren't wild about it either because, and we'll get to why supporters like this bill. But the reason I don't like it is because anytime you impose rent control, you're limiting the supply of housing by limiting the ability of people to make money on building rental housing. So once you limit the supply of housing, you are going to immediately see a rise in the cost of apartments under this provision, I think. But supporters say, look, you know, the supporter behind this is actually, interestingly, and this is where we get into 34, the supporter, the backers of this bill are actually the LA AIDS Healthcare Foundation. So you might ask yourself, why is the AIDS Healthcare Foundation involved in this? Well, their director is a guy named Michael Weinstein, who is very famous, was a very big player in California politics, and it's always about rent control. And his argument is, the cost of housing is multifactorial. You know, we know that California has a high cost of housing, and there's a bunch of reasons for that. But the most immediate thing we need to do is, as he says, take care of the patient in the emergency room who's hemorrhaging right now. And that is people who can't get into a really lower priced kind of accommodation, that our rental prices are too high in California, and we can deal with these other problems, you know, environmental regulations and construction quality, whatever. We can get into all that stuff some other time, but he says right now, triage is necessary. We've got to get in and stop the rise in rental prices so that people can afford more rents. We need rent control. Now, that group, Michael Weinstein's group, has tried this twice before, 2018 and 2020, and he has had his hat handed to him. He's lost by margins of 40 to 60%. I mean, Californians do not apparently like rent control. So this may not work, but maybe the public mood has shifted and people like rent control this year. But just in case that's true, the second ballot we want to talk about here, Proposition 34, goes right after Michael Weinstein's group. Now, it doesn't say we're here about rent control. This is the California Apartment Association saying there's one group in California that abuses the healthcare system. And they identify where Michael Weinstein gets the money to fund these very, very expensive initiatives. To run a ballot measure in California costs tens of millions of dollars. How does Weinstein, who's running a healthcare foundation, get this kind of money? He participates in a federal drug discount program. Stay with us. So the federal government negotiates down the price of some drugs, including AIDS drugs. It just absolutely discounts them dramatically and then allows groups like the LA Healthcare Foundation, AIDS Healthcare Foundation, to buy these drugs at well below market rates. Michael Weinstein's group turns around and resells the drugs through its pharmacies and to managed care organizations at a much higher rate. So he's buying them at discount and then charging the AIDS patients far more money, which is typically paid for then by their insurers or whomever. So he takes the difference, the profit on this, and plows it back into propositions like Proposition 33, which aggravates to no end apartment owners and should aggravate everybody who's sort of sensible, I would argue, about policy. But that's how the money works in this system. So Proposition 34 says, you know what? We need a new law. We need to require that people who participate in the federal drug discount problem, a discount program, plow back 98% of their income from that program directly into patient care, and that they can't use it for politics or anything else. That applies to exactly one entity in California, Michael Weinstein's Foundation. So this is a battle of two groups. One group that believes rent control is so urgent that though our real program, we say, is about AIDS, we're going to get involved in rent care year after cycle after cycle after cycle, and we're going to spend tens of millions of dollars that we get from a federal drug discount program. And the other group saying, you do this and you're coming after our members who build apartments and who own apartments. We're going to take you down. So this is a really pitched battle, and depending on your sense of the rightness, the correctness of using a federal drug discount program to fund your political operation, so far nobody has, you know, declared that it's absolutely illegal and taken Michael Weinstein to court, and Weinstein himself declares this is totally reasonable what I'm doing. I'm participating in social good. This is a social enterprise I've got going. Or if, like me, you think, you know what, rent control is dangerous and disastrous, whatever its source, This is a couple of ballot propositions you really want to pay close attention to. 33, again, would eliminate any restrictions on rent control. 34 would undermine the model that Michael Weinstein has used to push rent control propositions. So there it is. I hope that's clear as mud.
Now, what about Prop 35? This is the one that I didn't understand that well. It was very technical.
Prop 35 is, to me, one of the most complicated. I'm just going to call it a swindle. I just got to put it this way. Here's what it says, and I can understand its popular appeal. You can understand why people would look at this and say, you know what? We should tax managed care companies more because they're part of the healthcare system. They're probably making a bunch of money. Let's tax them at a higher rate.
What are those companies?
Management care organizations are typically, sometimes almost quasi-government sorts of agencies. We have Medicare. Almost everybody knows the federal program called Medicare. But in California, the system that manages that federal system is called Medi-Cal, right? Many states have these kinds of local state systems. Our Medi-Cal system, in turn, is managed frequently by companies or quasi-public agencies at the local level. So you might have Cal Optima, for example, in Orange County. It's called LA Help, I want to say, up in Los Angeles County. But there are these kind of county-run health agencies.
So they're like government agencies.
They're like government agencies that operate with other big providers, you know, Anthem, Blue Cross, Kaiser, et cetera. So what this law says is, you know what, we ought to tax those managed care systems to help pay for the costs of health care. They should pay more in taxes. Well, here's what's interesting. It's the managed care organizations that will pay the tax who are also the supporters of this tax. So you pause, as I did when I read this, and I said, huh, why would somebody want to tax themselves? Here's where the mystery gets really fascinating. They would tax themselves because if we give them a dollar and they pay, let's say, 10 cents in tax on that dollar, just for purposes of this ballot proposition. They pay 10 cents on that dollar, 10%. That 10 cents goes into a new state account for Medi-Cal. Now the federal government says, as part of federal law, we match everything you raise into that system. So we're going to give you 10 cents for every 10 cents you raise. Now the state system, Medi-Cal, has 20 cents, right? It got 10 from the managed care organization, and it got 10 cents from the federal government. Now it has 20 cents. Where's it going to spend that money? With the managed care organization that it just taxed. So now it gives that 20 cents to the local managed care company, which pays 10%, or in this case now 2 cents, back into the system, which is now matched by the federal government, and goes back to the managed care system that was taxed. If that sounds like a shell game, it's because it is. This is one of the most fun ballot propositions we've got in terms of just the way in which it's organized. It's like one of those games I had when I was a kid where a boot comes down and kicks a bucket and a ball bounces out and goes down a ladder and tips a mouse into a basket. It's amazing.
So what are the proponents saying about this?
The proponents are saying that it's time to tax the rich, by which they mean these managed healthcare organizations. It's time to make the rich pay their fair share because we have a healthcare crisis that must be done right now. Now, they know how the system is really set up to engineer this contribution from federal taxpayers to juice it up. They understand that. And I suppose they're right in a sense that it will bring more federal money into the system, but not because it's actually raising taxes on the local providers. So this is really a grab for federal money. And it'll be interesting to see if some federal agency steps in and says, you can't do that. So that's a long play. And the system is so complicated that, again, it's one of those things you and I have talked about many times before, which is that when the voter goes into the polling place and steps into the booth and closes the curtain behind, or more likely sits at home at the kitchen table and reads this thing one night under a tiny cone of light, they say, I don't understand this at all. Or they say, I think it's time the rich pay their fair share. I'm for more taxes.
Now, what about Prop 36? This is on drug addiction and crime. This is Prop 47,
yeah,
kind of adjusting Prop 47.
Yeah. What this proposition does is it repeals reforms Proposition 47. Travel back with me in time 10 years ago to 2014. In 2014, California's voters who now may regret their decision in 2014, passed Proposition 47. Among other things, this was an idea that we had to reduce the penalties associated with criminal activity because maybe we were being too harsh to criminals. And that if we just lowered this, we would lower the rates of incarceration, people would live better, they wouldn't find themselves in prison so quickly, we would reduce the prison population, it was going to be a lot of good things for a lot of good people.
It would be spending the money on people before they go to prison.
That's right.
Instead of them going to prison and spending the money on the prisons.
One of the key examples of this was it changed the whole way we calculate felonies and misdemeanors in California. So, for example, it raised the level of misdemeanor crimes to $950 in theft. So if you stole something from a store, for example, it wasn't a felony until it hit $950. So now we're all familiar, if we watch any television at all or read newspapers, we're all familiar with people who go into grocery stores and simply
calculate.
They calculate, how much can I steal here? They put it into a basket. And nobody stops them either, because if the police do show up because you've just said, hey, you know, Will just walked out with $948 worth of hair care products, the police say, well, what do you want us to do? Write him a ticket? Because he's not going to jail. Haven't you read Prop 47? So now people who run stores, pharmacies, whatever, don't even bother to call the police because the police don't typically do anything because there's no value in just the paperwork associated with filing a ticket with somebody, trying to track them down, write a ticket, and then have them not show up to pay the ticket either. So one of the things this has done, that the proponents of this, now this measure was brought to us by district attorneys all over the state of California, who have just seen the ability to prosecute low-level crimes just disappear. And what we now know is that there are repeat offenders. There was a woman who was just finally stopped by the city attorney in Long Beach, and I think it was because she had committed like 30 thefts under $950 over a period of about 3 months or something. And it got really ridiculous, and the city attorney said, fine, you're a habitual person. Now we're going to prosecute you. Well, her defense is, Prop 47. Every time I stole something, it was under $950. Their argument is, you did this multiple times. So one of the things this initiative would actually do is take a person like that and say, you know what? We're going to cut you slack the first two times you steal under $950. But the third time, we don't care how much it is. It could be $2, it could be $50, it could be $948. The third time you commit theft, it's a felony. It would also create stiffer penalties for drug dealers, drug traffickers, public drug use. So the other thing that its supporters point out is it would help end the kind of the business model of living homeless on the streets of California. Right now, if you're homeless, if you talk to a lot of people, as I do in the public policy world, who actually try to work with homeless people, one of the complaints they have is that it's much easier now after 2014 to live on the streets. Because you can go out and steal enough stuff and use it to either keep yourself alive just by using that stuff, or you can resell it on the streets to other people.
Go get drugs.
Yeah, go get, and then you use the money to go buy drugs because there's no violation of under Prop 47. There's minimal enforcement of drug use and public drug use in homeless encampments is fairly common and, you know, not looked at as strange behavior as it would be in most polite society. So the advocates, the supporters of this bill, these district attorneys say, like, look, this thing not only unleashed retail criminal activity, it helps sustain homeless encampments and life on the streets for a whole bunch of people. There's also a provision that would allow special penalties for people who engage in what's called a smash and grab kind of theft. We've all become familiar with this. It started roughly, I want to say, 2019, 2020. We really started to see a lot more of this. And it's, you know, literally it's a group of people go into a store, they overwhelm the employees, they smash everything, and they grab as much stuff as they can, and they leave quickly. And employees get hurt, they get beaten up, they get run over. It's a pretty terrifying experience if you just look at the video or if you know someone.
50, 60 people come and they, overwhelm the store.
Just overwhelm the store. It's typically organized.
And cause a lot of damages.
Causes a lot of damage. I mean, it's a terrible thing to have to witness. And the businesses frequently don't recover. And San Francisco is very upset that retail establishments are now leaving. You know, big cities have all of these problems. You know, the $950 limit for a felon, on a felony. the smash and grab stuff, the public drug use. So retail stores are closing in some of these cities where the prosecution has been uneven and where this, where Prop 47 has just unleashed this criminal activity on their establishments. So that's why our district attorneys, and I'm begging people, pay attention to your district attorney. He or she knows what they're doing. If they're backing this thing, they're saying, please give me the right to prosecute people who are repeat offenders of criminal activity. Now, who opposes it? It's people, again, who believe that any kind of incarceration, any kind of public safety and law enforcement is really aimed only at people of color. It produces unequal incarceration. More black people, more Latino people are convicted of these kinds of crimes. And so it's inherently racist. But the prosecutors who are behind this are not, I think it's safe to say they're not doing this because they're racist. They're doing it because they don't like crime. And the public doesn't like crime, typically. The people who get most adversely affected by this kind of crime are people in the inner cities where the public defenders, I'm sorry, where the public prosecutors have simply said, we're not going to enforce any law anymore.
Do you think they also are afraid that a lot of people will go to prison? Is that that's another
yes.
argument?
Yeah, the other argument is, yes, exactly that. That the people who will go to prison, number one, are people from marginalized communities, black, Latino, et cetera. But that it will also increase the numbers of people in our jails and in our prisons. In fact, one provision of this measure would allow judges to send somebody to a state prison rather than just to a county jail. Going to a state prison is a much tougher stretch than doing some time at the county jail. The county jail, you're still at least close to your family, your friends, your old neighborhood. When you go to a state prison, you may be going, you know, sometimes hundreds of miles away from your home. So you're going to be doing stiffer time. State prisons are simply tougher places to be than county jails. And yes, this will increase the number of people in those in that system.
It's great that you explain these propositions because a lot of times they're so complicated that people don't know how to vote for them. It's good for people to see different sides of them and gather as much information because a lot of times when we do these ballot propositions, they're complex and then they impact the future of California.
Well, that's right. You know, Californians have a history of voting for things which they come to regret. And I think, you know, the biggest challenge that voters have is waiting until the last minute and then they walk into the polling place and they just kind of really quickly read a title. So the titles can be misleading. And if you're not really thoughtful about this, then it becomes a challenge when you start to study this thing too late. And also the ballot descriptions can be themselves quite complicated. I do think it's an interesting, I'm a geek. I love to go through the sample ballot and read the arguments in favor, the rebuttal against the argument in favor, the argument against, the rebuttal to the argument against. I read the whole thing. I really enjoy it. I underline it, I highlight it, and then all of my friends and family call and say, what the heck does any of this stuff mean?
Do you have any other thoughts for our audience?
Yeah, I would say not a thought for your audience, a thought for you. That I think, you know, if people are really worked up about something I said, if they believe that I'm not really understanding what's behind it, then I would encourage them to recommend to you directly somebody who could come on and make that case. We've still got some time before the November election day. So I'm all for having conversations. I think the most important thing, maybe the most important takeaway is to have the kinds of friendships that allow you to talk as friends respectfully about differences of opinion. And sometimes those differences are simply going to come down to worldviews that are not entirely compatible. There are some people who simply think what we really need is more government, more regulation, and then all of our problems will be solved. And there are other people who, honestly, like me, who think that a lot of the problems we have could be eliminated or at least reduced substantially if government just tried to do less.
You know, and this is what I really appreciate about this country, because a lot of people with different views come together and work together. We've been losing some of that in the last
yes.
few years, but in general, this is where people are very open-minded and they work together.
So that's right.
We would love to have other people come on and explain their sides.
I hope you do.
Will Swaim, president of California Policy Center. It was great to have you on California Insider.
Thanks so much for having me. I always appreciate it.